You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled First Steps in Christian Religious Renewal. This is Lecture 4, given in Stuttgart on June 14th, 1921, in the evening. Rudolf Steiner. I think this should again be a kind of discussion time. I surmise that you will have quite a lot on your minds. Please feel free to express yourselves about everything. Emil Bach. We are concerned about the issue of the ritual, because we cannot develop a new formulation of the ritual out of ourselves. Rudolf Steiner. We will certainly need to develop some symbolic elements in this direction. This means that in the ritual of which we have spoken, we must work on individual examples of ritual forms. The form of the ritual is such that one will come to it once one has the prerequisites for it. Naturally, it is absolutely important to accustom yourselves to creating pictorially what you are so used to considering intellectually. I think Mr. Uli said some things today about the way the element of ritual is handled in the Waldorf School. Ritual is difficult to form, because for a long time people have limited all ritual to the traditional form. All ritual forms that exist today are actually ancient. Only here or there are they somewhat reshaped or rearranged. Furthermore, during a period when humanity has lost its ability to create pictorially, people also resist ritual in a certain sense. Perhaps it will help you understand the ritual if we add a few things to what we said this morning about a completely different ritual form. You know that actually everywhere that real inner community is sought, ritual plays a certain role. I remind you only of the fact that as the somewhat questionable Salvation Army spread, even it sought to have a certain ritual. We know, too, that the temperance movement has a kind of meager substitute for a ritual. Wherever a true community movement is to be the goal, some form of ritual is striven for. Now, as you know, the modern Freemasonry movement is an extensive community. This Freemasonry movement also seeks to nurture the building of community through ritual. It shows what ritual must inevitably become when it passes over into a purely materialistic movement. For Freemasonry is the materialistic form of a spiritual movement. You see, in their ritual acts and ritualistic symbols, Freemasonry essentially presents the mystery of the being of the human being. If you consider and study the actual being of the human being in connection with the world, the materialistically minded researcher today will say to you, the human being actually has the same muscle forms and bone forms as the higher animals, even the same number of these organic forms. The human being is a higher, fully developed animal, an animal that has been reshaped. More or less clearly spoken, that is what lies at the foundation of our knowledge today. This knowledge is immediately done away with when we consider how human beings integrate themselves into the entire cosmos in a totally different way than the animals do. The essential aspect of the animal, if we disregard isolated exceptions or variant forms, is that its spine is built in the horizontal. Please do not misunderstand what I mean. Naturally, there are animals that can sit up like the kangaroo and appear to have their spines built at an angle to the horizontal. Similarly, certain birds, parrots, have more or less a vertical stance. But this is not a predisposition of, nor dependent on, the organic constitution. Nevertheless, It is not within the structural nature of an animal to lift its spine out of the horizontal. The essential aspect of human beings, by contrast, is that the structure of the spine is vertical. The human spine is formed in the vertical. This is one of the essential characteristics by which the human being differs from the animal world. To see this, you need only reflect on the fact that one cannot consider a being in the world as being separate from the rest of the world. You see, it would not occur to anyone examining a compass to say that the needle points by its own nature in a certain direction. One would naturally say that the earth has a magnetic north pole and a magnetic south pole. This means that the whole earth directs the compass needle. In the case of organic nature, however, people like to explain everything in the organism out of the organism itself. They do not bring the human being into relation with the whole universe at all. Those who really understand the matter bring the organism into relationship to the whole universe. The situation there is such that systems of forces go through the entire universe. One system of forces circles around the earth horizontally, and the other systems work so that, interspersed with the horizontal forces, they move in a radial direction. Human beings have their spines in the direction of the radial forces and integrate themselves totally differently in the universe than the animals, which have their spines, the most important line of their body, in the horizontal, parallel to the surface of the earth. Many other things are based on this. The human brain weighs 1,300 to 1,400 grams and would, if it exerted its full weight, crush the blood vessels beneath it. The brain is absolutely capable, because of its weight, of crushing the blood vessels. Why doesn't it? It doesn't because the brain is immersed in cerebrospinal fluid. The cerebrospinal fluid oscillates through the subarachnoid space that the spinal column builds within itself. This fluid flows up and down under the influence of the breathing. The whole brain swims in cerebrospinal fluid. Perhaps you know from physics that a body loses as much in weight as the weight of the volume of liquid it displaces. Thus, instead of pressing down with 1,300 or 1,400 grams, the brain presses on the blood vessels with 20 grams at most. The human brain is set up not to remain subject to its weight, but has an impetus to overcome its weight. This is possible only if the human being has a vertical spine. The animal's brain presses down with its full weight because the subarachnoid space passes horizontally into the brain. The circulation that is produced in this way proceeds in a totally different manner. We must not look merely at the structure of the human being, but must also look at how the human being is inserted in the universe. If we do this, we may conclude that if we examine the exceptional position of the human being in the universe, several important lines above all arise. And there's a drawing on the back blackboard. First is the line parallel to the surface of the earth, the horizontal. Second is what differentiates the human being from the animal, the line of the spine that stands in the vertical on the horizontal, and there's sort of a cross picture. Thus we have two drawn figures, first the horizontal or level, and second the right angle. When we are aware of the significance of the horizontal that the animal basically creates, and the significance of the right angle for the placement of the human being in the universe, we can connect certain imaginations with the horizontal and the right angle, which by this means can become symbols. Among its symbols, Freemasonry, which seeks to characterize the nature of the human being, has the level, the horizontal, and the square, the right angle. It also uses other symbols that reproduce through and through the forces of the universe, leading us to the following observation. Imagine the earth here, human beings move, let us say, on the earth, I will draw it in a radial movement. Human beings then have their direction in the vertical, and the way in which they connect with the center point of the earth is a triangle. Freemasonry, in turn, has the triangle as a symbol in its ritual. Everything in Freemasonry, in the first degree, is thus taken from the configuration of the human being. There you see how symbolism is developed. Symbolism, where it is real, is not thought up arbitrarily. We arrive at symbolism only when we study it in reality. Symbolism is founded in the universe. It is there somewhere. This is true of the ritual, too. Human beings are so constituted between birth and death that they have within themselves forces that constantly kill them. These are forces that harden them. They are the hardening forces that work to bring about the skeletal system. In their illness-causing nature, they can lead to sclerosis, gout, diabetes, and so forth. Human beings bear these forces within them as hardening forces. This is the one system of forces. The other system of forces that human beings have within themselves is what constantly rejuvenates them. This system of forces comes to expression particularly in pleurisy and fever illnesses, in all that burns the human being from within. In the anthroposophical worldview, I have called the hardening forces Ahrimanic forces, and the forces that lead to fever, the warmth forces, Luciferic forces. Both of these forces must be held constantly in balance in the human being. If they are not held in balance, they lead the human being, soul and spirit, they lead the human body, soul, and spirit to some disastrous extreme. If the fever forces and the hardening forces, the salt-building forces, were not held constantly in balance physiologically, the human being would necessarily develop either a fever or sclerosis. If human beings develop only their intellectual or rational forces and tend toward intellectualism, they succumb to the Ahrimanic. If they develop only the fiery element, passions, the emotional, they succumb to the Luciferic. Thus the human being is always in the middle between two polarities and must maintain the balance. But think about how difficult it is to maintain the balance. A pendulum, which should always be in balance, always tends to swing out. There are these three tendencies in the human being: the balance tendency, the warmth tendency, and the hardening tendency. The human being must remain upright. Therefore, we may view the human as a being constantly seeking to maintain uprightness, verticality, against the forces that constantly endanger human life. The third degree of Freemasonry presents this. A Freemason, initiated in the third degree, is presented symbolically with how the human being is threatened by three rebellious powers that approach and threaten life. This is done in various ways. The simplest form is this. The candidate is brought forth in a coffin, and three murderers who want to kill him slip up to him. And beholding this threefold danger, the candidate becomes conscious that the human being is in danger of death in every moment and must rise up. Thus couched in this symbolism, the human being experiences a kind of real ritualistic act. He experiences ceremonially something really important that is connected with life. It is really true that we must learn to know life, because it is from life that we receive the symbols. Freemasonry certainly has its shadow side in the fact that it uses these symbols, performs rituals in blue masonry in the first three degrees, while in the higher degrees there are many other things. And this ceremonial element is drawn out of ancient traditions that are no longer understood. There no longer exists a connection with the origins, of which I wanted to provide a little sketch for you. The people see only the ceremony, and that is the dangerous thing. They remain stuck in the ceremony itself. They are not led into the ceremony in order through it to come to the spiritual. There is another way that people still relatively late, indeed still in the 18th century, had a quite lively feeling for making world secrets present. For example, when you open up the illustrated books that were still widespread in the 18th century, which were meant to make human beings aware of much that could not be expressed in intellectual concepts, you will see a picture that appears again and again. You will find a man depicted with the head of a bull and a woman with the head of a lion. The man with the head of a bull and the woman with the head of a lion stand beside one another. At first this is shocking for those who do not understand it. It is really true that we human beings are so constituted that in form we are most perfect in our physical body. There we are actually human. As you find presented in my title, Outline of Esoteric Science, the physical body goes back to the primordial beginning. It is the most perfect or most complete member of the human being. The human etheric body is formed like the physical body. If you could take away the physical body from the etheric body would conform more to the astral body. This etheric body would then, probably to the displeasure of quite a lot of human beings, take on an animal form, as it would become the expression of the emotions and the passions. It, the astral body, is formed differently with different human beings. When we look at the male head, the etheric head, as expression of what lives in the emotional nature, we have there as a type, as an average, something bull-like. In the female head, as soon as we examine the etheric head, we have something lion-like. These are average forms. You can feel this morally when you go into what comprises the nature of the woman, how she is the lion-like type. You can feel the bull with the man and the lion with the woman. These things seem to be spoken of merely metaphorically, simply as images, but they are drawn out of the supersensible nature of the human being. If the astral body is examined, separated from the physical body, it takes on complicated plant forms, and the capital I of the human being is a purely mineral, crystal-like formed being, formed completely geometrically. Thus, we can say that with regard to form, the human being is in the physical body, human, in the etheric body, animal-like, in the astral body, plant-like, and in the I, mineral-like. If we know all of these things, we think of how in an earlier clairvoyant condition, the people really knew of the higher worlds and formed these pictures out of these higher worlds. Now I am telling you this just to point out how symbols arose and how they were passed on as tradition. Today it is possible to come to symbols only if we very lovingly steep ourselves in the world secrets. And only out of anthroposophy can a ritual or symbolism actually grow today. You see, it is quite necessary that we proceed from the basics. First, in a certain sense, we must live again into the genius of language itself. Precisely where civilization is at its highest, our language has basically taken on a terrible outer abstract form. We speak today without feeling in our speaking. Today's speaking is actually terribly inhuman, because we no longer live within our language. Take the German word Kopf, head. When we feel it, we feel immediately that it absolutely has to do with the round form, with being rounded off. In contrast, when we say the Latin word testa, that has to do with testing, with testifying, or with assessing. This proceeds, therefore, from out of a totally different foundation. And if you feel what lies in each of these words, you will then also feel the difference between the Latin and the German elements. the German language forms a word out of the sculptural element. The Latin, Roman, builds it out of mental information. The word fus, foot, is connected with furcha, furrow, groove, rut. Pied has to do with placing. This kind of thing is found everywhere in language. And we can feel everywhere how a special feeling for the world comes to light in the genius of language. Consider how strongly people in Goethe's time still felt the pictorial element of language. Recall the scene in Faust where the poodle appears on stage, runs behind Faust and Wagner says of the poodle, zweifelt. He means by this expression that the poodle is wagging its tail. With the word zweifeln, today it means to doubt, he is expressing the movement of the tail. When you look at what still lived as the picture element then, and compare it with today's abstractions, how you had the word zweifel, this wagging and swinging back and forth, you can really feel your way into the pictorial manner in which language worked. This is the first element of the picture nature of the soul life, when we live into the pictorial nature of the language. It is really true that we grow into the pictorial element of language if only we want to do so. It is actually a very good training for the soul to grow into the picture nature of the language. We speak so much in abstractions that the words mean nothing to us anymore. You see, where I come from, a certain kind of lightning is called Himmlatzer. I should like to know who does not feel the picture of this lightning in Himmlatzer. The word paints it. And thus it is thoroughly possible, when you really go into the dialect, to grow into the picture nature. You should indeed train yourself to achieve the pictorial element of the language. It is sometimes almost impossible today to express what we need to, because the picture nature of the language is lost. We must, of course, disregard all artificially thought-up things, pictures. It is the same for those who somehow get crackpot ideas, such as was the case with the dun horse, which was walking with a friend and was talking energetically when it walked into a tümpel, or pond. The horse thinks about this. Tümpel? Oh, temple. Naturally, you may not just think up crazy things by seeking such outer similarities. You must deepen yourselves inwardly into the picture nature of the language. Then you will truly understand the word zwei, two. Originally, zwei was not thought of as putting together one and one, but rather breaking one into two pieces. The older forming of numbers was based on analysis, taking a thing apart, and not synthesis, putting things together. You can follow this, for example, when you look at the Arabic arithmetic that existed still in the 12th post-Christian century. An interesting little book by our friend Ernst Müller about Abraham ibn Ezra is out. I will give you the exact title tomorrow. The book is about numbers, and is extraordinarily interesting for knowledge of how numbers were developed in earlier times. When you follow this, you will find, without spinning any crazy ideas, the similarity between the word zwei and the word zweifel. It also leads us to the final syllable L-E-L. In this manner you can find your way into the picture nature of the language. This is the ABCs of pictorial imagining or ideation. Another necessary thing is to find your way into the complicated way in which the human being is constituted. I have pointed out a few examples of this today. As I said, if you attain true knowledge in this way, images will begin to rise that are symbolic, and you will come to really grasp the evolution of life. Then you will come to the point of being able to have the ritual act before you, imaginatively. Take, for instance, the following. The Greeks were not yet able to fully separate concepts from objects. Similar to the way we perceive colors, the Greeks once perceived concepts on objects. For them, the concepts were perceived. If we take this as our starting point, we can really understand how much humanity has changed since the time of the ancient Greeks. Were we to portray, for example, an altar in an appropriate way to the Greeks, we would have to present it in bright colors. If we wanted to set up an altar that was more for modern human beings, it would have to be in rather more of a blue color. Modern people are not so organized toward the lively, bright colors. The ancient Greeks did not have a perception of color in the sense that we have. When you approach a congregation or community with the ritual, you must make the ritual extremely simple. A complicated ritual would not satisfy human beings today. Thus, you must form it so that it is extraordinarily simple. Above all, throughout the ritual, there must be an expression of the inner transformation of the human being. We could call this inner transformation of the human being the enchristing or enchristing of the human being, or the imbuing of the human being with Christ. Human beings are not born imbued with Christ beforehand by way of inheritance. They must find the Christ in themselves. This transformation, this enchristing of the human being, can be expressed symbolically in a multitude of ways through simple but effective ritual acts. Let me give you an example. If you were to form a verse or mantra, you would have it consist of 7 lines. In the first 3 lines, you would essentially express the nature of the human being when still under the influence of the conditions of inheritance, as born out of the Father principle of the world. The 4th line, the middle one, would depict how the principles of inheritance are overcome by the soul principles. And the last 3 lines would describe how the human being becomes one who grasps the spiritual. Now you could read such lines as these to the community, so that you read the first 3 lines with a somewhat more abstract, colder voice, the middle line forth with a somewhat warmer voice, and the last 3 lines in elevated speech, in an elevated tone. And in this you would have, in a simple form, a ritual act that would present the enchristing and spiritualizing of the human being. It is not a matter of explaining it afterward. That is precisely what should not be done. You should let it, the verse, be felt. The picture should be felt, and you should act accordingly. Thus you see how it is possible to rise up to the ritualistic nature. Then, too, you must develop a feeling for how everything that has to do with thinking is similar to light, and everything having to do with love is similar to warmth. Just think what a powerful resource you have in the language. Whenever you bring what you want to express, that tends toward thinking together with the light. When you say, quote, "May wisdom shine through the human being," close quote, you have said something real. You will feel how what has to do with thinking is actually gathered light that becomes thought. Let me say that again. You will feel how what has to do with thinking is actually gathered light that has become, that becomes thought. Likewise, you must use images suggesting warmth when you speak of love. When you say, quote, "A shared idea spreads warmth over a human community," close quote, you have the image of warmth within it. You have said something real. Thus, when you feel the inner wisdom of the language, you enter into the imaginal or picture-like, the world of images. That is one way. I will give you more detailed examples sometime later when we come together again. You can even develop a modern ritual based on these things. I wanted only to indicate today the practical aspect of how we are led into this reality. It is, however, always a question of our emaciated souls. Please excuse the hard expression. We are not human beings at all. We have become so deadened by materialistic education. People feel everything as separated. They do not feel that their nerves catch the light. that their nerves glow through and through with the light. They believe that vibrations occur, yet thought forms out of the light. It is not just a picture. It is a reality when we say, quote, the human being is radiated through by thoughts, close quote. People realize this much too little, and therefore they cannot achieve pictorial imagining or thinking. Yet I believe that if, for example, in order to visualize how it all takes its course in pictures, you read my title Outline of Esoteric Science, and immerse yourself in the way I described the three metamorphoses, Saturn, Sun, and Moon, then you will come into pictorial imagining of your own accord. If you do not remain with the abstraction, or believe that I have constructed or simply thought out something, but rather if you feel that it is necessary that these things be represented in this way, then you have already achieved a kind of training for pictorial imagining and thinking. And everywhere there you have the opportunity of passing over into ritualistic acts. You must also develop, out of what I have presented, a feeling for the inner numerical arrangement in the universe. Today we are often laughed at when we speak of the numbers 7 or 3 in relation to the order of the universe. Yet these numbers are simply there to be found empirically in the universe. I should like to know who does not think of the number 3 when they think of the human being. A human being is simply a threefold being, and you come everywhere upon the number 3 when you think correctly about the human being. When, for instance, you speak to a group of older children and say, quote, may light, your thinking, shine through you, close quote, you are not done speaking if you do not immediately add, quote, may life, your feeling, stimulate you or penetrate you, and, quote, may fire, your will, strengthen you through and through, close quote. Things arrange themselves of their own accord, and this flows over into the ritual form. One must develop a feeling that something is incomplete if one says merely, may light, your thinking, shine through you. That is the same as if I were to place only a human head there. That cannot be. I cannot imagine anyone placing only a human head there. That cannot be. The rest must be added. Therefore, I must have the feeling that if I say, quote, may light, your thinking, shine through you, close quote, it is incomplete, and I must add, may life, your feeling, penetrate you, and may fire, your will, strengthen you through and through. If I take only the one of the sentences, it is the same as if I have only the human head. Thus we come to the point of always thinking the rest in addition. Then we enter into the self-creative nature of the numerical organization of the world, and so there ensues from the issue itself the ritualistic form. Quote, may light, your thinking, shine through you. May life, your feeling, penetrate you. May fire, your will, strengthen you through and through. Close quote. This underlies what Mr. Uli will have told you today about the Sunday or religious service in the Waldorf school. The ritual lies in the formulation. It is actually formed in this way throughout. It is difficult to understand when it manifests in life. You see, if you were to separate out a chapter out of my title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, it is almost as if you were to cut off an appendage from the human body. The book is intended as a whole, for it is a special form of thinking. It is not put together out of individual parts. It was allowed to grow of its own accord, and it can be developed further. Paul Baumann, could you tell us something about the musical element in the ritual, Dr. Steiner? Rudolf Steiner. The situation is this. We human beings are so placed in the world that we are, I will draw it immediately on the blackboard, and there's see plate 2, page 181, on the one side a head organization. This head organization is dependent upon the fact that the outer aspect of the world penetrates into it and is everywhere checked. Everything from the world penetrates into the head, is mirrored in the head, and what we perceive on the outside is what has been mirrored. This is what we usually have within during waking consciousness. And when you consider the structure of the human being, namely what the eye, EYE, does, but also the other sense organs, then you find that everything there tends to be limited or blocked off in the back. Something is reflected. On the other hand, the human being also builds the skeletal system, the muscular system, and so on. With the head, we have actually the round, closed skull. Then we have the bones filled with bone marrow, the muscles, and so forth, and there's another picture. The head is actually such that what works into it cannot penetrate through it, just as a mirror is impenetrable for the light, and so it mirrors or reflects. What we call, in the widest sense, the limb metabolic system is different. There, what comprises bone and muscle is taken in from the world. Therefore, we can say, in the head organization, everything is thrown back, but the limbs take in. Actually, the processes of the limb metabolic system are brought about from outside, through the way and manner in which I am integrated in the world organism. Nothing is thrown back there. It is, as it were, organized through and through. It is taken in. And it stops, is backed up, namely in the lung. The lung is an organ that stops up. It is where the outer aspect of the world is fashioned into forms. A second, quite refined, blockage is in the auditory organ. The auditory organ is actually a lung at a higher level. Whoever has a sense for it can see on the structure of the outer ear itself that it is not formed in the same way as the eye is. The eye is formed from outside inward. The auditory organ is closed off and encompasses the actual sense organ. All of the auditory organ that is visible is formed in such a manner that the human being is built out of two vortices. The one vortex is thrown back. It reflects. It goes back into itself. The other vortex builds an organism, develops the forms. It then approaches the other vortex, and they collide there. Here, there's another picture. So that everything that comes in from outside is reflected here and yields ordinary memory. For example, the memory of images one has seen. In contrast, what builds up the human being is movement, absolute movement. It consists of vibration forms that run their course in the human being. I have already told you about the cerebrospinal fluid. The human being is made up of about 92% water and only about 8% solid matter. The solid part merely integrates itself into the rest. The whole is movement. What organizes the human being through movement is the word. The human being is really, in the literal sense, word become flesh. And this word become flesh collides with what is reflected, so that we can say we are first of all built according to the visual, which is, however, completely organized by what is thrown back or reflected. Then we are built according to the auditory, by what forms the human being, tone formed into words, which then is backed up in the hearing and becomes audible tone. Human beings become conscious of the outer world through the direct or transformed visible aspect. Because of what becomes tone within, what becomes the musical aspect, the human being is the being who rises up out of the sphere of the musical and is fertilized by the sphere of the optical, the visible. So that in fact the musical element is that which works further in us from out of the cosmos. We are built by music. Our body is embodied music. This is so in the fullest sense. And the light works in here and is reflected. This is the greatest difference between the ordinary memory that we have in regard to the outer world, where we have the visual aspect, and the musical memory. The musical memory is something totally different. This will seem wonderful to you. The musical memory arises in the opposite way, through the damming up or holding back of the tone flowing through. In musical memory, human beings throw their own nature back into themselves. Thus what works in us as the musical element is our innermost nature. Now, think about the fact that we produce pictures in some way, be it visibly before people in the ritual, or be it that we call forth images through our speaking. And then we imbue these images with a musical element, either with an instrumental or vocalized music. It is no different than basically the two main world principles being brought face to face with each other. What the human being is as light creation is brought into connection with what the human being is as tone creation. And the ritual becomes thereby, and there's a gap in the content, polarity. Of course, this is already the case with the word, and therefore the older rituals have not used the abstract speaking, but rather a declamatory aspect that has something that is song-like about it. And this declamatory element, which already played an important role in the old Mass, because the Mass was sung, should absolutely represent the penetration of the light aspect with the tone. Thus, the musical element in the ritual is what most essentially spiritualizes the human being. It furthers the mystical element, whereas the rest furthers what is pantheistic, the pouring out of the human being into the universe. Thereby we can, on the one hand, impel the human being to expand through all that is light or thought-like. On the other hand, through the musical element, we can lead the human being into contracting into himself or herself, into taking in the supersensible. And while, for instance, the non-musical, the light element in the ritual, works to bring us a world feeling, the musical works to deepen in us the I feeling to the point of the divine. The ideal would be to work with the light element to a certain degree, and then to let it pass over into the musical element, into the musical. Through this, we would truly have brought the image of the makeup of the human being into the ritual. Gottfried Husemann asked if the music up to this time, Bach, for instance, could still be used. Would not the new ritual also call for a new kind of music? Rudolf Steiner. If it becomes necessary to do something quickly, people will re-enliven the old music. Yet it is absolutely true that human beings can no longer gain a completely inner relationship to these older forms. It is precisely the same as the fact that adults cannot develop the same life forms that children do. It is absolutely necessary that music be fashioned out of feeling as it is today. One must naturally begin where one can. You will have already noticed that where we do eurythmy and work into the musical element, our friends have already discovered good musical forms out of the musical feeling of our time. This stems from the fact that human beings will, more and more, retrain and change their thinking in the musical field, just as in that of painting. There are clumsy attempts that we do not need to judge, but we must know that they are just clumsy attempts. Also, in music, as for instance in Debussy, who projects himself into the individual tone, who lives in the individual tone. Yet it may not become a tone painting, or the pictorial in music. It is true that people will experience evermore what reveals itself like a mystery within the single tone. And then they will seek to analyze the individual tone. Perhaps they will have to expand the scale by inserting a few tones, and yet enrich it mainly by experiencing the characteristic of the single tone. Through this, special musical possibilities will result. And then addressing to Mr. Baumann, "Also, you hope, do you not, that one will already experience whole melodies within the single tone? It is indeed true that this can be done." Therein lies a possibility for training. In this, the anthroposophical musicians will have to come to meet other musicians. I am certainly of the firm belief that the anthroposophical musicians will have a very great deal to do. Precisely, the anthroposophical musicians will have an immense mission. The old music had actually come to a dead end before Richard Wagner. Wagner did not actually advance music. He expanded music by bringing it into a side stream. We can find his music to be great and genius in nature, but it is a tributary. He will have to take up musical development before Wagner to find there precisely what can contribute much to the ritual. In the meantime, it will naturally be quite all right to use the older music. Basically, there are actually wonderful things to be found in both Protestant and the Catholic Church music. For the modern human being, there will no longer be a totally inner relationship with the music. You will have to attempt to deepen yourself in the musical element itself. Beno Bach asks a question about the Quaker movement. Rudolf Steiner. "I have always had the feeling that the Quaker movement is something that comes specifically out of the Anglo-American element. In Central Europe, there are no longer any more significant bases for the kind of community building that manifests in the Quaker movement. I do not yet know firsthand of any attempt to build community in this way, and so naturally cannot know whether there can be something within it that is fruit-bearing or not. I doubt, however, that anything similar to the Quaker movement can grow out of the Central European spirit. For you see, the Anglo-American actually experiences the religious in a thoroughly different form than the Central European does. The Central European experiences the religious, first and foremost, completely in thinking. This is the primary phenomenon. It is undoubtedly a mystical element that is illumined by intellectual light. This is everywhere within it, even where totally radical religious forms and sectarian efforts arise. You will find everywhere in Central Europe the mystical radiated through by intellectual light, thinking light. Whereas the Anglo-American allows the religious element to be still immersed in the human instinctive nature. Of course, this exhibits itself in various ways, and it would be interesting somehow to examine out of which blood mixture the Quakers recruit their members. You must go to the instinctive blood nature. There you will find the foundation. You will surely find something like an instinctive tendency. Central Europe, however, never founds out of an instinctive tendency anything that builds community. This is really an essential difference among the West, Central Europe, and the East. The West seeks the higher aspect more or less in subconsciousness. Central Europe seeks it in consciousness, and the East seeks it in superconsciousness. In the East, people are absolutely always looking upward. The American looks to the earth and expects everything from the earth. The Russian, even more, the Asian, always looks upward. The Central European looks straight ahead. It is indeed the case that if we try to imitate the actual Western element in the religious realm, we could enter dangerous paths. We may not do this in any realm. In natural science, it has brought great harm. and in the religious realm it leads quite especially to rigidity and paralysis. We must work more with the soul than with the body. Emil Bach. We have heard that there are already rituals in existence that have been given an occasion, a baptism ritual, a funeral ritual, and part of a revised Mass. I want to ask if it would be possible for us to become acquainted with these rituals in order to live into them ourselves. Rudolf Steiner. Certainly, these things would be considered as starting points. The funeral ritual came about because a member of our movement wanted such a ritual. Of course, we had to connect with the existing funeral ritual, but because that ritual was translated, naturally, not a dictionary translation, but a correct one, something resulted that was essentially different. I would ask to have these rituals back and would gladly base our course of study on them. I will simply ask our friend to copy them and send them to me. This is quite possible to do. The same is true of the Mass. In the first place, so far, I have only made a translation of the Catholic Mass. Yet it, too, has actually become something new. However, I translated only as far as the offertory, so it is not yet finished. In the old Catholic service, the Mass is read in the language of the country. Our friend has gone so far as to read the translation of the Mass up to the offertory in the old Catholic service. These things need time, and we have little time. Yet all of this can be made available to you. Only it would naturally be necessary that, above all, a new baptism ritual be created. The old baptism ritual is not quite appropriate, because everywhere its goal was to baptize adults, and that baptism was then applied to children. If we want to baptize children today, we must find a new ritual. Also, for this ritual, there are already elements in existence that I can make available to you. The baptism rituals came out of baptisms for adults. When we baptize a child, we are speaking to one who is not yet conscious, and the ritual must correspond to this. The child knows nothing of the baptism ritual. We may not go so far as to oppose the baptism of children. We can keep that. However, much in the ritual must be redone and made new. John the Baptist's baptism consisted in immersion in water. The adults were immersed in water. You know that in this baptism, the human beings can be brought to that point of consciousness at which their life appears before them in a tableau. Their life appears in a kind of tableau, and by means of this, they experience that they belong to a spiritual world. This is actually expressed in the baptism ritual, but it cannot be done with children. For children, we must have a ritual that expresses how the child is accepted and taken into our community. And the religious suprasensible substance that lives in the community must stream over onto the child. This must be expressed in the baptism ritual, and it can also be done. You see, until now there has been no reason in the anthroposophical movement to develop these things really concretely, simply because we actually wanted to avoid it. There are not a few instances where people wanted to introduce such things. I always refused, because from the very beginning on, it would have killed the anthroposophical movement. One had to remain with what is halfway allowed. 20 years ago, today it is less so. The Catholic Church considered itself as having a monopoly on ritual. We would have been eliminated immediately, and for this reason, there was little motivation to develop ritual in this direction. The rest, where, of course, ritual was developed, was interrupted by the World War. We could no longer go any further with it, because if we had, we would have been handled as a secret society. These are the reasons that the aspect of ritual in the anthroposophical movement was not developed. However, in your movement it will be possible, because it can be considered quite natural that ritual should be formed in a religious movement. Even though Protestantism has a certain horror of ritual, I believe that people can feel the need for ritual again. A participant. The Catholics have more sacraments than the Protestants. Why is that? And what is the meaning and significance of the ritual act of communion? Rudolf Steiner. What exists in the Catholic dogma goes back to certain forms of more ancient knowledge. One imagines that the human being passes through seven stages between birth and death. The first stage is birth itself. The second one is what we call maturation or puberty. The third is the becoming conscious of one's inner nature around the 20th year. The fourth is the feeling of not corresponding to or fitting into the world, of not being completely human. Then comes the gradual growing into the spiritual. These things then become somewhat shaky and undecided. But one envisioned the whole of human life, including the social, in seven stages. And one imagined that between birth and death the human being grows out of the spirit. Today the Catholic Church does not recognize pre-existence. There exists only a thought of God. And this growing out of God's thought is presented in seven stages. Different forces must confront each of these seven stages. Birth is development or evolution, and maturation is an evolution. For every evolutionary form, an involutionary form is set over against it. For birth, baptism. For puberty, confirmation. Each sacrament is the inversion of a stage of natural development. We can say that Catholic doctrine presents seven stages of development, and it places over against them the seven involutionary steps, and these are the seven sacraments. Four of these involutionary steps are earthly: baptism, confirmation, communion, and confession. These four are generally human, like the physical body, etheric body, astral body, and the eye. When you go up higher, you come to spirit self, life spirit, and spirit human. As the shining in that takes place from out of the spiritual world, the last three sacraments are those that go into the social sphere: marriage, ordination, and the last anointing. The penetration of our world by the spiritual world is expressed by ordination. Thus, these are the seven sacraments, of which the last ones are marriage, ordination, and the last anointing. The sacraments are simply inverse processes for the natural processes that take place for the human being, and the ritual acts are arranged in accordance with these. The idea of the seven sacraments is not arbitrary. It is much more arbitrary to limit these seven sacraments to two. This happened in a time when people no longer had a feeling for the inner numerical makeup of the world. These are the things, naturally, that make serious Catholic priests, namely those who are members of an order, despise Protestantism so much. They consider the whole of it to be a kind of rationalism, as something that no longer knows anything. There are real spiritual natures among the priests in the orders. The Jesuits are prepared and trained for this. Among the priests at Mont Cassino, I found Father Storkman, with whom I spoke about Dionysius the Areopagite. He showed me the altar where he usually read Mass, and told me about his feelings concerning the Mass. One saw that his feelings had nothing to do with the usual creed of the Catholic Church. And at another time in Venice there was a patriarch who was a terrible fellow. Another, a younger cleric, preached, and I saw spiritually that he was really permeated with spirit. The sermon was also quite fine. Through the ceremony, the ritual, specific things become noticeable. I also saw Mass read in the subterranean level of a church in Naples. With the transubstantiation, I could see what lies behind the Catholic transubstantiation. It is indeed the case that when a real priest executes the transubstantiation, the host receives an aura. You may believe this or not. I can only tell you what I saw. We do not need to avoid saying it. There is indeed an inner reality in the ritual. There is no doubt of that. We then see precisely the defects in Catholicism when we see what it once was and what has been lost in the rationalistic age. It is senseless that Protestantism has taken out of the seven sacraments only two. There is no reason for this. Emil Bach. May we also ask what the laying on of hands was in early Christianity? Rudolf Steiner. Here, you must be aware that humanity has gone through an evolution, and that certain spiritual forces which existed in ancient humanity receded more and more as the human being became more intellectual and developed freedom. In relation to natural life, certain forces receded. As a result, people do not understand many things that are recounted in biblical history, things that mean something quite different from what people connect with them today. For example, I draw your attention to how terrible and revolting the modern age sees something like the relationship of Socrates to his pupils. People speak of a kind of homosexuality, whereas in reality it points to an aspect of the soul forces, by which, not through the word, but through the presence of Socrates with his pupils, something was brought about. The presence of the human being meant something to them. It is a revolting and false representation when today the concept of homosexuality is used in connection with these matters in those times in Greece. And thus it is also with touching in the laying on of hands. The human hand is important, essentially not only for feeling, but it also emits or radiates something. This emanation was stronger in earlier times. The hand can receive something that heals. I have often said in lectures that human life is a whole. Childhood belongs together with the later ages of life. No one receives in later life the power to bless who was not able to pray during childhood. Those who never folded their hands in prayer during their youth can never bless with their hands. The laying on of hands was simply a process of consecration, and there's a gap in the notes, which is involved in the laying on of hands. This was something that was developed earlier, and we should contemplate the healing effect of the laying on of hands. Modern human beings are no longer in the same position. They are not urged to develop such a capacity in their youth. People developed such things in earlier times. It was once a reality. Yet this does not preclude the possibility of developing this ability again in a more spiritualized future. Would you not see this as desirable? The folding of the hands is a preparation for blessing. In like manner, in old Catholicism, for instance, the following was taught. If you learn to kneel, then you learn to say in the proper manner, Dominus vobiscum, the Lord be with you. Do you think that is strange? You know how one says, Dominus vobiscum. This is learned through kneeling. Otherwise, it has no power. A participant. It was said that the priests of ancient Egypt held positions of extraordinary leadership. We heard that the initiates led the people, that they worked through real thoughts. The question is how this would have to be modified today through the new way of working. Rudolf Steiner. Yes, it must become new, inasmuch as we may not return to that strongly unconscious, atavistic way. But we must become much more conscious and pay attention to the fact that all human beings must develop themselves into individuals. It is still the case today in Catholicism that the personality of the priest is completely suppressed. When the stole is crossed over the heart of the priest is only a figure or representative of the Church. He is no longer a human being. We may not cultivate this. Precisely in the ancient Egyptian priesthood, much depended upon the fact that actually, as long as the high priest lived, the others were only allowed to be figures or representatives. Only when the high priest died could another step in. There was always only the one. We must exclude all of this today. A participant. What can you say about the priest's vestments? Rudolf Steiner. Liturgical vestments arose so that one might imagine the color of a personal feeling in relation to reality. For example, one imagines a priest giving a blessing. This results in a particular coloring of the astral body, and the liturgical vestment is fashioned accordingly. Blessing produces an absorption of the individual personality in the suprasensible world, and from it the blessing streams onto the congregation. This leads to a blue inner vestment and a red outer garment. One simply makes a copy or image of the astral body. The same occurs in other acts, praying and so forth. Imagine, for instance, that one has an outpouring of spirit. You can follow this quite exactly. The color of the astral body gives the color of the priest's vestment. The liturgical vestment is simply the coloring of the astral body. This could absolutely be duplicated. It is a question only of whether humanity is mature enough to validate such a thing. I had a friend who was an excellent Protestant pastor, who had a great ideal. That is, he had many beautiful ideals, but among others he wanted to do away with the Luther frock. He wanted to go around like an ordinary dandy. It embarrassed him not to be able to go around like a dandy when he was a pastor. Therefore it was quite painful for him not to be able to wear the modern aesthetic men's clothing in which one is harnessed in two stovepipes. Today this hideousness is regarded as the only possible garment, and whatever else arises as new is as foolish. The greatest foolishness is our men's suits. Given a humanity that puts on a frock and sets a cylinder on top, it is clear that human beings of this kind cannot have an understanding of or sense for ritual vestments. Humanity must be re-educated. Perhaps when women also take up this profession, a way will soon be found to come to proper vestments for the rituals. Women will certainly have to do something to attain the pastor's position. But men today want to do things like the Swiss lecturer, who found it proper, for example, while giving talks, of course not sermons, to waltz a cigarette back and forth in his mouth as he spoke from the podium. This is the way he held his lectures. You know, of course, that the ritual vestments were not restricted merely to the church. Judges also wore vestments. And if you expected judges today to put on old ritual vestments, they would rebel against it. Yes, even royalty went around in a kind of ritual vestment. And finally you have in the universities the rector's cloak that is always passed on from one rector to the next. In this connection, we need change only our aesthetic imaginations, and then it will work. The end of Lecture 4.